Beginning of Parshas Dvarim, we have a recap of the establishment of the system of judges that we first read about in Parshas Yisro, which actually yields a question that over there, the eponymous Yisro is the protagonist of the story. He tells Moshe, Novel Tibol, you're going to get worn out, you need to delegate, you need to have a hierarchy of judges. And Moshe says, great idea, and he does so. Here we pretty much have the same story again. This time Yisro makes no appearance. Commentaries discuss that. Some say it was really Moshe's idea anyway, just that he credited Yisro, who came up with it. He was generous by giving credit, but he would have done the same thing regardless. So when he told the story, he didn't feel the need to mention Yisro. Be that as it may, we have the story. It begins around Sheni and Parshas Dvarim. It says, Moshe complains, Eicha Esa Levadi, how can I support you? How can I carry you on my own, by myself? Tarchachem, Masachem, Verivchem, your Tircha, your weight, your quarrels. Rashi brings from Chazal, Tarchachem, Lamed Shel Yisrael, Tarchanim. Everyone would, they were just, they didn't give up easily. They were tenacious, I guess is a good way of putting it. They would just, like bulldogs, they wouldn't give up. They would say, I have more witnesses, I have more of this, I have more of that. They were difficult people to deal with. So Moshe said, I can't do it. So I suggested that I will delegate, we'll have a hierarchy of judges. We'll find Anashim Chachamim, wise men, Nevonim, Viduim L'Shivtechem, men who are knowledgeable and intelligent, and I'll appoint them as leaders. And you agreed, you said, great idea. And I found them, I found Anashim Chachamim Viduim. I appointed them as leaders of the nation, the Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meos, Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Aseros. And I commanded them as follows. The charge for the Dayanim, their charter was, V'atzaveth Shoftechem Ba'isahi Leymar, Shamoa Bein Achechem, Hear disputes among your brethren, Ushfat Tem Sedek, and judge justly, righteously, Ben Ishu Ben Ochevu Ben Geiro, Losakiru Panim Bamishpat, don't play favorites. I saw Navar Bernel, who explains this pasuk. He calls it Melitza, he calls it kind of maybe not the literal reading of the pasuk, but he has a kind of homiletical interpretation. Losakiru Panim, some people judge by looking at people's faces. He looks honest, and he looks like he's lying. I have a gut feeling and intuition that he's telling the truth, and so on. Torah says, don't do that. We have a system of evidence and due process, and we discussed in the past. Don't paskin just based on Panim. But the simple reading of the verse is just, don't play favorites, don't have your biases and partiality towards one or the other. Takaton, kagadol, tishmaun. Here cases whether people who are important or less important or large amounts of money and small amounts of money, everything should be treated equally. The egalitarian impulse, everything has to be fair and equitable. Lo seguru mipnei ish, you shall not be afraid of anyone. That's also part of the charge of the judges. Kim mishpat le'elokim hu, you're doing God's work. Padavar asher yikshem mikem, that which is too difficult, that you pass up to me. Takrivon elai yushmativ, and bring it to me and I'll take care of it. And that's the discussion of the judges, parallels the one in Yisro. So there are a number of different halachas here, as we see in these verses, about judging fairly, all the basic standards and rules for judging honestly and fairly. I want to focus tonight on the verse, on the phrase, Shamoa bein achechem, hear among your brethren. Simple reading just means, here are the cases that are put to you by your brethren. There is a Talmudic interpretation that this refers to a point of process, a point that when you hear cases, you have to hear from both sides equally. Both sides have to be present. Neither side shall speak not in the presence of the other one. As we'll discuss, there are actually several different prohibitions that one violates by failing to do this. This is what the law calls ex parte communication. Sometimes that means a process which only has one side, but it's often used to mean improper contact with the judge by one side. That's a big no-no. It's a big no-no both in modern jurisprudence. It is a big no-no in halacha too, as we'll see. It is something that halacha warns you, dire warnings against doing, having any communication with one side, even if it's ostensibly honest and above board. But with the law, we talk about conflict of interest and appearance of impropriety. Even appearance is wrong. And halacha, as we'll see, the halacha has a deep suspicion of any communication that isn't all transparent and the presence of both sides is dangerous and suspect and automatically, by definition, illegitimate. As we'll see, too, this is something that there's been a fair amount of controversy about. Over the centuries, this was often honored in the breach, and as we'll see, various poskim have discussed it, tried to either limit it or qualify it or find justifications for why it often seems to be flouted. Even today, as we'll see, It's an ideal we strive for, but isn't always followed as much as we would like. So we'll discuss now what the sources are, what the concern is exactly, and what exceptions there might be. So the Gemara talks about this in several places, in Sanhedrin, in Shavuos, elsewhere. One Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara says that Amar Rabbi Chanina, our pasuk of Shema ben Achechem, and only then Ushvatem, is an Azhara LeBeistin, it is an admonition, a prohibition for the Beistin. Shlo Yishma Divrei Baldin, Kadam Sheva Baldin Chavero. Beistin should not hear one side before the other side has arrived. There's also an Azhara for the Baldin himself. He's prohibited from making such communication, and so on. The Gemara goes on and says, Rav Kahana says that one violates the verse of Lo Sisa Shem Hashav, that hearing falsehood, a lot of things prohibited by that. One of them is holding ex parte communication. That itself lends itself so directly, so clearly to saying falsehoods, you actually violate Lo Sisa Shem Hashav by holding an ex parte communication with a disputant. You also violate Min Vashekar Terchuk. The Gemara in Shavuos says a number of different things that are considered violations in an expansive sense of the pasuk of Min Vashekar Terchuk, of staying far away from falsehood. One of them is holding any ex parte communication with a litigant, a judge, with a disputant. That automatically violates Min Vashekar Terchuk because it inevitably leads itself to Sheker. Why exactly is this such a problem? What is the rationale? What is this assumption that any communication that is not held in the presence of both litigants is suspect of Sheker? So Rashi makes a couple of points, which these two points are mentioned by many of the later authorities. Rashi says, first of all, that a person has the freedom to lie, to say whatever he wants when he knows that the person who knows the truth is not here. He feels he can get away with more, so he's more brazen, he's less circumspect in what he's going to say. Moreover, he says, when he's first, then the dying hears whatever he has to say without the presence of the other person. The first impressions are a big deal. First impressions are hard to eradicate. The dying hears his side of the story, even though later the other guy will come in and say, he told you what? That's not true. And he'll say his side of the story. It's too late. Once the dying is heard, even for a period of time, an uncontested account, a tendentious, partisan, uncontested account of the affair, then it's difficult or impossible to completely eradicate his first impression. Many of the commentaries make a point that the Ralbag makes in a particularly clear way. The Ralbag mentions briefly on this parasha, as well as in his commentary to Mishlei. The pasuk there has the phrase, Tzaddik Harishon Berivo. The first person in a quarrel and a dispute is Tzaddik, is going to be the one judged righteous. The Ralbag explains this means that the first one to talk to the dayan, he'll get the first word in. The dayan will have forever after a partiality to his side, even if his side is subsequently contradicted. It'll be very hard to get out the first impression. That's why he says the Mishlei is making an observation. That's how human nature works. The Ralbag explains that's why our parsha says Shema ben Achechem and Lasisa and the other gemaras. That's why the Torah is so concerned about this, because the first impression is indelible, is very difficult to subsequently uproot. Tzaddik Harishon Berivo is a deep truth about human nature, and therefore it's so important not to let this happen in a Din Torah. We have basically two reasons which are interwoven. One of them is that when one person is there by himself, he may be emboldened to say things that he wouldn't have the chutzpah to say in the presence of the other side. Second thing is that even if both sides are saying exactly what they would say if they were both together, but the one heard first, is going to leave a deeper impression, and that those are reasons why we should not let one side speak not in the presence of the other side. And the truth is, it's impossible, I guess, to do this perfectly. The human beings being what they are, we can really only listen to one person at a time, so when we actually have a basin proceeding, one side has to speak first. Not only that, but we tend to be pretty strict about not having them interrupt each other. It happens all the time. One side is telling the story and the other side starts to boil and you see him tense up and your energy is about to spring out of his seat, and he does spring out of his seat and says, that's not true, what? And we always suppress him and we tell him, you know, give him a chance. For the sake of decorum, we have to have people present their sides independently without battling each other, without descending into a verbal brawl. So we do require that one party be given the chance to present his side. But that's not as bad because, again, A, because at least he's in the presence of the other party, so he knows the other guy's looking at him, daggers, and he knows the other person's going to get a full rebuttal. The other person knows exactly what he's saying and is making notes and is prepared to rebut it. And B, once the judge is there and both sides are in front of him, I think the assumption is he's already listening with suspicion, and he knows the other side is there, and he sees the other side's going to get a chance. That's not as bad. But if you're there with nobody there and you have the relaxed opportunity to present your side, other guy's not coming for another hour, that's more of a danger that your side will become indelibly marked on in the consciousness of the judge. We certainly are very stringent about that, yes. Most of the discussion of the post-com concerns the case, the question of before the case has been done. Certainly, I don't know if I saw any real halakh discussion of that, but certainly as a matter of practice, I can tell you from personal experience, we are extremely strict about that too. We will not allow any follow-up communication, any communication to be made by the litigant to the judges. Anything has to go through the office. If anything has to be submitted in writing and immediately forwarded to both sides, or made in an open court in the presence. Yes, we certainly are strict about that, although most of the discussion concerns before a case starts. But you're right, I think many of the same concerns do apply afterward. So that's the concern. That is these are the two kind of twin reasons. And that's the prohibition codified, Gemara, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, and so on. Black letter law. Now we know that throughout the generation, certainly anyone who has studied or has read Tshuva Svarim knows that Dayanim frequently addressed that Rabbanim, authors of Tshuvas, Dayanim, rabbis frequently have addressed letters and discussing the case without giving their opinions on cases, even on Chosh and Mishpat, even on civil law cases, without having had the benefit of both sides appear before them. So the question is, how do they do that? So, and this is where the whole debate starts, and we have a number of actual tshuvas that where they actually acknowledge this, and they explain why they think what they are doing, the authors, why they think what they are doing is legitimate, and yet there are some pretty big disputes about this. To turn to some of the classic tshuvas on the topic, one is by the Rashbash. That is Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, the son of the Tashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach Duran. Rashbash was a leading North African authority in the 15th century. He was accused in some contentious matter by one of the partisans. He was accused of having violated this halacha by having issued an opinion without having heard the cases of both sides. So the fellow quoted him, the halacha, and how can you do this? How can you violate this? Then I'm frequently charged with violating this halacha with more or less legitimacy. So the Rashbash was challenged back 600 years ago, was challenged by someone that he had done this. So he said, nope, I have clean hands. I did not violate the halacha. I know the halacha. I follow it. I cherish this law, he says. It's absolutely, I have no problem with it. What I did does not violate this law. And he explains as follows. He says, this prohibition is to a dayan, to a judge who's hearing a case. He shouldn't hear communication from one side privately. However, he says, my father, the Rashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach Duran, other Rabbanim, he says, who preceded him, there's a well-established tradition, he says, they were frequently asked to offer an advisory opinion on some matter. That's what Tshuva Svarim are full of. They, he says, they are not gozrim shadin kahu. They are not ruling in an authoritative, binding manner. They're not paskening the din Torah, issuing a controlling opinion, he says. They're just saying, im ha'inyan kach adinu kach, what we would call an advisory opinion, or simply expressing their view of the halacha without giving a formal, binding psak. The local judges, he says, they can see, they can read the opinion, they can see if the facts were presented correctly, the facts, they know the facts because they actually heard the case, they heard the testimony of witnesses, and they heard the claims of both sides. So if the facts as recorded by the posek who wrote the tshuva are correct in their understanding, and if they agree with the logic and the reasoning, they can follow it. If not, not. This is what the Rashbash says. What he seems to be saying is that you cannot issue a binding, controlling opinion without hearing both sides. You can feel free to offer an advisory opinion, which you record the facts that you're addressing, give an opinion regarding those facts that has no binding authority. It's simply informational. It's simply academic sort of for the people who actually do have jurisdiction to read the reasoning and to consider your analysis. He's not paskening. Therefore, what he's doing is perfectly acceptable. Now, the Rashbash can really be understood in several ways. The way I said it, what I thought the simple reading is that he was not the actual judge in the case. He was simply offering an advisory opinion for the benefit of the judges, whoever they might be. There are others who seem to understand that the primary point of the Rashbash is that he was not answering actual litigants. He was consulted by a rabbinic colleague who could be trusted to be impartial and who himself had heard both sides of the story. So he was not directly addressing disputants in a matter. He was addressing a rabbinical colleague as a rabbinic courtesy. Both these points are made by different poskim, whatever the Rashbash himself meant. These are two of the main justifications rabbis have given for holding for issuing rulings without the benefit of a formal proceeding with both sides expressing their claims in the presence of the other one. A, I'm not issuing a binding controlling opinion. B, I am addressing a neutral party. I have not heard the case from either of the two litigants. Nevertheless, there are others who take a much dimmer view of this kind of enterprise and who basically shut down even this, even issuing an informal advisory opinion. Even this, there were some postmen who were against. One of them is a more or less colleague of the Rashbat, and that is the Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet, also an North African authority a little bit earlier, maybe half a century or a century earlier. He in passing, strongly criticizes the practice of doing this. He says he was misled. He didn't realize that the person who posed the question to him was a disputant. He implies that had he been answering a rabbinic colleague who was neutral, he might have been okay with it. He didn't realize, he said, that he was posed the question by a disputant. He says, even though what he said had no binding authority, nevertheless, it was the wrong thing to do, he says. That one should not normally answer a question posed by one of the two sides, even if you're not the formal judge of the case. He gives two reasons why one shouldn't do that. One of them is, he says, because that you may get it wrong. And even though, again, no real harm done, you can just say, okay, you know, my opinion has no binding quality anyway, and I can always revise it when I hear the correct facts. That itself is considered disgraceful and awkward for a dayan to do. It creates laws, it creates a sort of chilul Hashem. And it doesn't promote the honor of the court for them to have to issue these half-cocked advisory opinions, which then have to be retracted. So you really shouldn't do that. Second reason, he says, and this is the reason that's really discussed much more heavily by the poskim. Second reason is, and this is a very powerful reason, if you take this seriously and literally, this has profound ramifications for the whole enterprise of paskening Dine Torah. He says, an advisory opinion can have, in the wrong hands, can have very unfortunate effects, he says, because if the fellow knows these are the rules and this is my case is going to hinge on X and the halacha depends on Y, he says he'll learn exactly what he has to say. He knows if I want to win, then the facts better come out as follows. I better make sure that the facts presented are as follows. So he says, by doing this, you are encouraging sheker, you're promoting people to say whatever it is they think they have to say to win. You are considered ka'arche hadayanin. We'll discuss what that means in a minute, and therefore that is wrong. The Rama in Shulchan Aruch, number 7, the Mechaber does not bring this opinion. The Mechaber just brings the Gemara's rule that you shouldn't issue an opinion in a binding formal capacity. Doesn't bring any of these concerns about a posek issuing a ruling in an informal capacity. The Ramah does. The Ramah actually says that in the last paragraph of number 7, the Ramah says, lo yichtav shum chacham psak le'echem bali adinim b'derach im kein. You shouldn't even write a psak in the contingent, if these are the facts, then this is the halacha. Because again, you have these two problems of the, first of all, he'll learn to say sheker, and also because you may have to retract, and it's zilus alachacham, it's considered disgraceful. Because of these two reasons, you shouldn't do this. Now, if you think about it, the concern about sheker basically torpedoes the entire advocacy system. There is no one who has the potential to cause as much sheker as a paid advocate who you hire to help you present your case. His job is to give you advice, not of course to say sheker, but his job is to explain to you what the laws are and how you're likely to win and how you're not likely to win and what to say and how to say it. Ain lacha, you know, risk of inducing sheker, gadol mizeh. If the poskim felt you shouldn't even issue an advisory opinion because it can lead the litigant to figure out what he has to say to win the case by hook or by crook, certainly you shouldn't act as advocate or counsel to a litigant. You should make him say the case on his own, in the dark. Just, he has no idea what the halacha is, so hopefully he'll tell the truth. And certainly the custom is not like this. The custom is that the basin system, both here and in Eretz Yisrael, does tolerate with more or less, with greater or less favor, but does tolerate a system of advocates, both paid as well as amateur, both lawyers as well as professional, ta'anim, rabbanim, for a variety of reasons. We do have them in the U.S. My understanding is that even if Batidin do not like them, they are reluctant to actually bar them because that might be because we operate as arbitration panels. If we want our things to be upheld by courts, we have to follow basic procedural fairness. And if we deny the right to counsel, we might get overturned on the grounds that we denied, you know, fundamental rights of a fair proceeding. In Israel, it's quite common too. They use it's even more well developed and professional, the system of Ta'anim Rabbaniim. So it would seem, certainly, if we're worried about the Rivash, you wouldn't even offer as a Rav an opinion, because maybe the litigant will learn to do, say, nefarious things. Certainly, we shouldn't allow people whose entire living is made by helping people win Dine Torah, which, you know, certainly the incentives are there for to win by hook or by crook. Yet the minhag is to be made. You know, and there is indeed a tremendous amount of debate among the poskim as to whether this ruling of the Ramah does seem to accept this, whether this ruling of the Ramah is accepted lahalacha or not. The truth is, as I note in footnote in number 6, the basic concern goes all the way back to a Rashba. The Rashba wasn't really giving a general rule for what a Dayan should or shouldn't do. In passing, in one of his tshuvas, he wrote that he kind of made a very cryptic statement like, the halacha will depend on the exact details of the fact, and I don't want to tell you those details because you may learn to be mishaker. So the Rashba, at least in one specific case, was reluctant to be too explicit about what the halacha would be because he was afraid that information in the wrong hands would not lead to justice, but to the contrary. But in general, based on this Rashba and this Rivash, the Ramah and many poskim arrive at the conclusion that a Rav, someone knowledgeable in Choshen Mishpat, should not offer even advisory opinions to anyone. Indeed, my chief back in Lakewood, my chief, Rabbi Dov Kahan, is extremely strict about this. You pick up the phone, you get through to him, and you say, I have a question. He'll immediately interject and say, is there another party involved? Is it just like a Hashavas Aveda question, or is there another party who is appearing as your adversary? And if you say yes, they'll say, you know, I apologize, but I cannot talk to you. The halacha in the Shulchan Aruch is that someone knowledgeable in Choshen Mishpat should not offer an opinion, even advisory, if there's another party involved.
The disadvantage of not allowing advocacy is it sort of says that inherently someone who knows less will
yeah,
be
so
less well.
I don't have a complete answer to that question. In a similar vein, I used to joke that by the same logic, taking it to its absurd extreme, I used to argue we shouldn't have shiurim in Choshen Mishpat. We shouldn't talk about Choshen Mishpat because everyone should remain in the dark. Like the Christians used to believe there was a capital offense to translate the Bible into the vernacular because only the priest should be able to have the information. Everyone should have to go through the priest. We obviously don't believe that. We're the people of the book. We believe that information should be out there. People should learn. But I see the specific question about doesn't this give an unfair advantage to the litigant? That is a real concern. I can't deny that. There's theory and there's practice. In theory, the idea is that the judges are supposed to know everything. That's why the halakhic system never developed. Advocacy was never a standard part of the system. We'll discuss soon what the halakhic view of advocates are, but halakhic system always developed, not like the modern American system, not like the modern Western system, it always developed with the notion that the judge should provide all advocacy necessary, should see both sides. In practice, though, certainly in today, the halakha also recognizes that we are in a fallen state, that we are not the judges of yore who are much better than us. We do not know everything. We're very limited. Halakha certainly does recognize that valuable information can be presented by the litigant. So then the question you have is, so then if one side inherently knows more, he's more of a danger, A, because he knows more, and B, because of the danger of sheker. So I don't really have a good answer to that question, but you know, I can see the point. It is a valid question.
So I actually can ask just to see that. But in addition to that, you're also not educating the bait. So if you're not giving them an opinion, how are they going to know what to do, and how are they going to
So even someone like my chief, he would, I think, answer a question. Again, the other distinction we made, he would answer a question from a rabbinic colleague, someone who was neutral and was not one of the partisans. He would consult with people like that. He wouldn't deal with a litigant himself. Frequently, a litigant approaches the Beis Din or the Dayan and says, I want to decide whether this case is worthy of pursuing. Is it worth my time? Is it worth your time? So that kind of thing he didn't want to do. He didn't want to deal with litigants. The litigants, he felt, should just find a Beis Din and go to them. If the Beis Din themselves wants to consult with them, that's fine.
Weren't these teshuvah based on
Yeah, so that was the point I meant to allude to before. Many of the tshuvos were written to local rabbanim or to inter-rabbinic kind of discussion, and that the poskim were much more lenient. Not everyone liked that, but that I think the poskim were much more lenient. It was the tshuvos that were asked by one side who presented his case, even if he claimed he was presenting both sides. That's where I think the primary reluctance comes from. In a similar vein, there's a kind of another example. This is a tshuva of the Rama himself. Rama was asked, I think by a student or someone he knew, it sounds like. He was asked a question involved Yerusha, we discussed a couple of weeks ago, about the laws of inheritance. The Rama says he is willing to answer. He says, despite the fact that Shema ben Achechem, you really shouldn't do that. He says, this is different, he says, because Yerusha cases uniquely, more or less, don't really depend on disputed facts. You know, who people are and who the relatives are, who's dead, who's alive, you know, these are not usually facts that are in dispute. The halacha might not everyone might know all the laws, but again, we're not talking about a case of a will or a contested will or cases of the intention of the tested, or it's a simple case of a man who died intestate. It's just a question of the laws of Yerusha, that there aren't really any facts in doubt, that there isn't really any danger of sheker, or there isn't really any danger of tendentiousness. Those kinds of cases, Poskim said, you can hear, but again, in the real world, most cases will have some element of, most real world cases outside Yerusha will have some element of tainus, of claims, and that poses a problem. Now, go back to lenient views. One of the classic lenient views was the Maril, also pretty much a 15th century contemporary of the Rashbash, Ashkenazic this time. His tshuva is a little complicated, his language is not so clear. But he also has a dispensation arguing that the halacha should be limited to a judge. He says someone who is a judge or expects to be a judge should not have ex parte communication with the litigants. However, he says someone who is not a judge, who's simply a rabbi, a qualified rabbi, and is asked for an advisory opinion, similarly to what we saw on the Rashbash, can offer an opinion even to one of the two disputants. He's not worried about the sheker thing, apparently. He just says if you're not actually involved in the case, that's fine. You can issue an opinion. Now, he goes on and says, even after he's done so, what if it turns out, after in good faith he heard the case, offered an opinion, now it turns out they want him to sit on the case, which can happen too. It's happened to me occasionally. So the Maril says, you can hear the case. And the logic he makes is that litigants have the right to waive this halacha. This is a very powerful point I think I've discussed in the past in the laws of Beis Din. Most of the procedural rules that are meant for the protection of the litigants, that are meant to ensure fairness and so, or, and some of the rules that are less clear what the reasons are, like certain people who are disqualified and can't do dinei Torah at night and so on, most of these halachas can be waived by the litigants. If the litigants understand, have full understanding of the situation and say, we don't care, we want this anyway, they have the right to do that. So Maril says, even though having heard an ex parte presentation by one side is a problem, it does tend to promote unfairness, nevertheless, Maril seems to say that litigants can waive it, if there's full disclosure made, if the dayan reveals to the other side that he was previously approached by the first side, and the guy says, it's okay, I trust him that he didn't lie, I trust you that you're going to be honest, it's not really a contentious case, you know, we both want to do the right thing, whatever the reason is, if the litigant says I'm okay with that, then you can use the dayan. And this is something that happens too. I've done this more than once. People have approached me, again, in an advisory capacity. I am not as strict as my chief is. I will sometimes offer, at least in a general sense, an advisory opinion. Then they'll say, okay, we want to come to you for a din Torah. So again, you have to emphasize full disclosure, preferably two or three times, and get it in writing and all that. But in principle, the litigants have the right to waive this problem. The Urim V'Tumim of Yonasan Eibschitz is, in general, very strict about this halacha. He acknowledges the Maril. He acknowledges the Rama, the Maril. Rama codifies this Maril, that the litigants have the right to waive this problem. However, he says, this is considered an impairment to the judge. It's a waivable impairment, but an impairment to the judge. However, the Urim V'Tumim says that's only if, as I said before, if a full and proper disclosure is made. The litigant has to have a clear understanding that this was done, and this could potentially impair the judge. He wants to waive it, that's his right, but he has to understand it. If full disclosure was not made, then he can say, I never agreed to this. I only agreed to the basin because I thought that this was being conducted honestly. And this, in general, the Rama Tumim sides with the halachic view of earlier authorities that having conducted an ex parte session is grounds for basically a mistrial, throwing out the whole case. It's grounds for vacating the verdict unless there has been a clear and explicit waiver of the problem. The fact that that they went ahead even after an ex parte communication, that is grounds for tossing the entire verdict. And that is actually machlokes poskim. Some poskim say l'chatchila, the judge has a mitzvah, maybe mitzvah daraisa, maybe drabanan, but it seems to be a daraisa. The Gemara brings psukim. L'chatchila, some poskim say there's a significant isser not to do this. But the avid, some poskim say it doesn't impair the dayan to the point that his verdict is that he's completely invalid. Others say no. The Rambam Batum and others say no. This is an actual psul in the dayan. It can be waived like other psulim, but it's an actual psul in the dayan. The dayan is pusul unless his impairment is waived by the litigants. Now, the Rambam Batum notes, he says, Bizman Azeh, in his time, in the 18th century, he says, people were unfortunately, Bavanasena Harabim, were lenient about this, were lax about this. Particularly, he says, in the institution of Zavla. Zavla is an acronym. Zayin Beis Lamed Aleph is an acronym for Zeh Barer Lo Echad. It is a form of kind of venue selection where if the litigants cannot agree on a normal Beis Din, there is a procedure established by the Talmud that each side gets to pick one dayan, and together the two dayanim pick a third dayan, a neutral dayan, so to speak, and he hears the case. Now, it seems historically from the earliest sources, Zavla was meant to be a normal fair Beis Din. Happened to be that each side would get a certain selection right in the judges, but the judges would act as normal, impartial judges. Over the years, however, the system degenerated. It became more that the two Borim, the two judges who were picked by the two sides, they became more of advocates for their side, and the real decision was made by the Shalish, was made by the neutral person, and the two Borim, we call them, really became some hybrid between advocates and normal judges and couldn't be relied on to be completely impartial. One of the early problems mentioned is the fact that the two Borim would often hold ex parte communications with their people who selected them. This is something that's been recorded for hundreds of years. The Rambam Batumim says it was common, it's absolutely wrong. He quotes earlier authorities that it's not acceptable. He says it's an avla, it cannot be done, it has to stop. He was vehemently opposed to it. There are some who tried to justify it. Several hundred years ago, one of the earliest tshuvas we have, a dayan named Rabbi Yitzchak of Posen, later in the Aruch HaShulchan. Rabbi Yitzchak of Posen's tshuva I have on the bottom here, number 8. He says people do it. He's not happy about it. He says the argument he makes to legitimize it is along the lines of what we said before from the Maharil and the Ramah, that even a significant impairment in the judge can be waived by litigants if they choose to do so. Even though in his time they weren't explicitly waiving this problem, he says, since it was so widespread, everyone knew this was going on, the system, you know, the corruption, whatever it was, the taint had spread to the point that it was understood as the normal order of business, that itself, kalkulasam, zui takanasam, can itself be self-legitimizing, because all parties know when they play into the system, this is how the system works. It's as if they explicitly waive it, we have a tacit, implicit waiver of it, and that is fine. He's not so happy with this. He says it's still not derech tovim. If it wasn't good enough for the Torah felt this is wrong. You really shouldn't be waiving this. The Torah didn't just feel it was wrong. It's exeris akasa. The Torah felt it was wrong because it leads to sheker. So there's language in the Zohar many achronim bring that someone who has an ex parte communication is like he worships idols. I'm not sure where that comes from, but the Zohar, the poskim were strongly against it. So to waive a rule of procedural fairness, which the Torah and the Gemara and the Rambam and all the poskim felt was a significant and important rule of procedural fairness, just waive it by minhag, he's really not happy with it. He says, Lamaisa, Mikra Din, it could be that the fact that it's ubiquitous itself is self-justifying. A little tricky. It's always hard to know how far to say this. If everyone was bribing judges, would you say the same thing, that the corruption is built into the system? It's hard to know how far to take this. He himself says it doesn't extend to anything that reeks of actual corruption. But this was the position taken by Rabbi Yitzchak of Posen, the Aruch HaShulchan, that because this problem is so ubiquitous, it becomes self-justifying in that it becomes the minhag. Many other poskim, though, were vehemently against this. They said no. Either they denied that it was the minhag, or they felt that we shouldn't be relying on a minhag and something that is so profoundly unfair and against the Torah's rules of procedural fairness. So that's a machlokas, whether the laws of Zebar Lo Echad, of how they apply, to, whether the law of Shema Ben Achechem still applies. Just one last word before we conclude. I mentioned earlier, the Rivash says that someone who helps one litigant and gives him the opportunity to say sheker, he's like Orchei Adayanim. Orech Din in modern Hebrew means lawyer. So some people today use lawyer as a slur, and that's what the Rivash is doing. The Rivash is saying acting like a lawyer is self-evidently pejorative. Now people point out, lawyers in Chazal are not exactly clear. We say Lekel Orech Din, Yom Naram, God is referred to as an Orech Din. It's really not clear exactly what an orech din is in traditional rabbinic Hebrew. The Mishnah says, "Al tas asmacha ka'orchei adayanim." Again, pejorative, you should not act like Archei HaDayanim. There are numerous pshatim about what exactly Archei HaDayanim are. Again, modern Hebrew means lawyer, but it's not clear what it means in traditional Hebrew. I saw one contemporary article. Someone was asking about Ar Shalik. He says, can you answer Shalik on the internet? They come in on the Ask the Rabbi email boxes. So he says, it depends on the different pshatim in not being Archei HaDayanim. There are seven different pshatim, he says. And he lists seven different explanations. The Rivash clearly felt that Archei HaDayanim was bad. He thought it meant that it leads him to say Sheker. Halach itself is kind of ambiguous, generally negative on that. There is a Gemara in both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi in Ksuvos, number two, which indicates that being an Arech Din is bad too. What the Gemara seems to be saying is helping one side in a zero-sum negotiation. There were technical questions beyond the scope of today's talk about, it wasn't actually litigation, it was a question of how they structured their affairs would be if one side chose, basically accounting methodologies, if one side chose to arrange his claims one way, he would stand to get more from the other side. If he arranged his claims differently, he would get less. So the Gemara says, advising one side how to present his claims, nobody was being dishonest. It was just the two legitimate ways of billing for something, and you get more if you structure it one way than the other way. The Gemara says, advising somebody to take advantage of the more effective way when you're not one of the two sides, unless it's your relative, is considered Archei HaDayanim and is wrong. The Gemara does seem to say that meddling in a case which is not your personal case, that's what Archei HaDayanim do, that's wrong, that's what the Rivash doesn't like. He says that it leads to Sheker, or it's damn not your business, you shouldn't be doing it. Again, there are many other pshatim in the Mishnah of Altas Atzlok Archei HaDayanim. It's a very murky and ambiguous thing, but the bottom line is, Halacha L'maisa, that there are those, the Ramah, the Rivash, who seem to be pretty strict, who argue that you shouldn't be offering opinions, even advisory opinions. That seems to completely negate the whole institution of the Tohen Rabbani. The Minag is and has been for a long time that we are more lenient for a variety of reasons, either because we're not issuing binding opinions, or because sometimes they trusted the litigants that they felt they were honest. Sometimes, like the Ramah said, there wasn't anything really in dispute, and so on. But certainly what everyone agrees is if you're actually in a position of authority, if you're actually the binding authority on a case, then it is a huge no-no to hold ex parte communication unless the litigants waive it. Even then, it's not a great idea, but there, grudgingly, some posting have allowed it if there is an explicit or even implicit waiver of this right by the litigants with full disclosure of the problem.